This is Virginia Insight. I'm Peter Norton, sitting in for Tom Graham. If you could redesign your community just the way you wanted it, what would you do? What if you could make the roads and streets, the paths, the playgrounds and the parks, the neighborhood gathering spots and the places in between what you wanted them to be? What would you do? This hour's guests say you can make your community what you want it to be. We'll hear their ideas, but they'll want to hear yours, too. Andy Baino is a professional urban planner who works with local residents to make communities more livable. He wants people to have plenty of choices about how to get around. Fionnuala Quinn is a professional urban planner who specializes in design for bicyclists and pedestrians. Fionnuala Quinn and Andy Baino have helped Virginians make their communities what they want them to be. We'll share their insights and yours right after the news. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Peter Norton, sitting in for Tom Graham. We're talking today about Virginia communities, how they are now, and more importantly, how they can be. Our guests are experienced community planners. We'll hear from them in a moment, but we want to hear from you, too. How do you think our communities should be designed? What's wrong with the way they are right now? And what would make them better? Our guests are Andy Baino and Fionnuala Quinn. Andy Baino is a professional urban planner from Timmins Group in Richmond. He works with local residents to make communities more livable, especially in terms of the transportation choices they offer. He writes about urban design and travels the country speaking to audiences of all kinds about it. Fionnuala Quinn is a professional urban planner for Alta Planning and Design in Arlington and vice chair of Fairfax Advocates for Better Bicycling. Like Andy Baino, she's also a civil engineer. She specializes in design for bicyclists and pedestrians. She grew up in Ireland, where she studied civil engineering at University College Dublin. Fionnuala Quinn and Andy Baino, welcome to Virginia Insight.
Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Peter.
I'd like to begin by giving our listeners a picture of what you do as planners. For each of you, who might a typical client be, and what would you have to offer them?
Well, I'll go first. Typically, our clients are local governments, municipalities, all sorts of organizations, planning organizations who are involved in the built world. You know, anything to do with the streets, the roads, how we get around our community. Now, increasingly, we also have been doing projects for other sorts of organizations who are getting involved in building rail trail projects, perhaps campus projects, universities who are looking to improve their walking and biking facilities on site.
And how about for you, Andy?
It's very similar. The typical client either maintains public space, so that might be a state department of transportation or a local public works department, or it could be a university or a college campus where they maintain streets that might be private streets, but people are walking, they're biking, they're driving on those facilities. And so it's problem solving is what we're being hired to do.
Could you give us an example of the kind of problem either one of you might solve?
Sure. One problem is, it's a common problem, talking about campuses. I was speaking with somebody today that said, so we've got this, we have a college campus and we have a huge parking lot, and we're having this problem where visitors come in and they're speeding through. You've got people walking from their cars to the campus buildings. What can we do? This feels like a crazy environment, and it's supposed to be this warm, inviting place. It's supposed to be this campus that feels comfortable to move around from class to class. And so they come at you with a problem like that, saying, "We don't know how to move people around safely. What do we do?"
And could you tell us what you can do in that kind of situation?
Usually the first step is to go out there with them and just observe what's happening around us. It might be that the parking lot is designed in a terrible way. It might be that they've got a little cut-through street that's designed like a highway instead of a cut-through street. But the starting point is go out and observe the conditions around you.
And then what kind of change might make that better?
Often it's designing little things a little bit differently. It's bringing curbs in a little bit closer together. It's making things more clear for a person walking to move from place to place, so that when you're on 2 feet, you can see clearly where you need to go, where you are in context with everything around you. I think that's...
Yeah, I think we've built a lot in our environment. Some of it has grown organically. Some of it's been put together a little haphazardly. It has history, how it's all come together. We can now go back and look and see how it all fits together. And we can use tools, like pretty simple tools like paint, new curbs, new sort of signs, new sort of designs to just say, well, let's take another look at this. How can we get people from one side of the street to the other more safely? What would make them more comfortable? How can we make this whole environment better? And while we're at it, improve the use for all users.
And so I'm imagining that maybe these paint markings or signs or pavement indications might be a message to the people around them that here's a place where pedestrians are welcome and drivers should be more careful. Or is it? Am I understanding this correctly?
It could be. There was an intersection that all of us were coming from out of town, so we all drove through an intersection coming in here where if you look off to the right-hand side, you could see what we call in the dorky professional community a goat path, which is where people walk over and over again in the grass, and it just blazes a path through the grass. So you can see a residential community off to one hand, and you can see this path coming through the grass, and it stops at the edge of a street. There's no sidewalk. There's no indication that drivers should be aware of people walking, and yet clearly there are plenty of people walking from their homes over to a shopping center on the other side of the street.
So it sounds to me like you're actually interested in what people are doing and want to do and not just in what planning experts think people should do. Is that fair?
Right. We want to look at what human beings are doing, how they've settled, how they want to move around naturally, kind of like the old water flows downhill. Where are you going to fight water?
And we're also going back and looking. A lot of it has been designed around motor vehicles and helping them through the environment. And now we're sort of going back and saying, well, wait a minute, we have other users who also need to move around in this space and they need to get from one side of that street to the other. How do we get them there safely, comfortably, et cetera, et cetera?
Okay, that's really helpful. Unlike most planners, I've learned that you're both civil engineers, and I'd like to know how you find that skill set influences you as a planner, maybe gives you something to offer that other planners don't have. Is that something you can comment on?
Well, to be fair to true civil engineers, I do have a degree in civil engineering, but one of my first bosses majored in art history, but he practiced transportation planning and transportation modeling. So I am as much a true civil engineer as that guy is an art historian. But it does help me sneak into secret engineering society meetings. It gives me an understanding, I guess, grounding of the real world around me. I know that you can't just come up with an amazing idea that looks good in Photoshop or some beautiful rendering that shows people everywhere and seems like an amazing dream but can't be built or is not practical for that particular town that you're visiting. So that civil engineering background does ground me to reality, I guess. Some might argue if I'm grounded to reality.
So, Fionnuala, do you have a similar answer to Andy, or is your experience different?
Yeah, somewhat similar. I mean, I think it always gives me a perspective on what we're talking about, because everything that we build in the environment has to work. It has to drain. You have to be able to see. It has to be practical to build. You have to be able to get the equipment in there to build it. You have to be able to maintain it over its life, how it operates, et cetera, et cetera. So you want to be practical about all this. You're dealing with public agencies who are taking responsibility on for this piece of infrastructure. And they have a lot of concerns and they have a lot of realities cost-wise, et cetera. And I did actually work on the other side for local government dealing with these issues. So I hope that gives me some perspective.
Well, do these clients sometimes want plans or projects that don't make sense from a civil engineering point of view?
Well, you could say if you're going to take a local street and convert it into what looks and feels like a highway, I would make a case that does not comply with good civil engineering sense, because then you're ripping apart the environment around you. You're introducing all sorts of new problems. Mm. Now you've got to put big drainage structures in. Maybe you need a new bridge, and you've got to widen a bridge. You've got all kinds of civil engineering nightmares where often a very simple, low-cost solution that makes it nice for people to move around, mm-hmm. either on their own 2 feet or with pedals, is a great civil engineering solution.
I think Fionnuala Quinn agrees with you, Andy, on this one. Just judging from her nodding along, that maybe sometimes smaller or simpler solutions might be the better path than major projects?
Yeah, we certainly need to step back and take a look and at what we've got and how we can shift things around to make it work better. And there's actually tremendous opportunity because we've built a lot, and sometimes we've built it a little too wide. We've built a little more than we need. There's opportunity there, very low cost, to recapture some of that for other uses.
I don't understand. How can something be too wide? You can always, you know, use more space for your car, right?
Well, shall I take that?
Go for it.
When something is excessively wide, it may be encouraging a car to drive a lot faster. Mm. Then may be appropriate for that environment. Could be a residential street. You know, a residential street that's extremely wide, do we really want cars traveling very fast down there? Perhaps some of that can be repurposed in other ways. And actually, there's all sorts of techniques to do that, even on non-residential streets.
Yeah, I would think if I was in charge of all schooling for professional planners and engineers everywhere, I would want them to learn human psychology more than a lot of other niche studies, because things like driving down a very wide road, your human nature just pushes down on the gas pedal. When you have a line of sight that goes from one side of your window, the driver's window, all the way to the passenger window, you see no obstacles, you feel very comfortable driving fast. When you see tree canopies come in, when you see other things around you, you naturally slow down. There's a lot of human psychology that ties to civil engineering, and especially how we move in our vehicles.
But faster is better, right?
Well, it depends, I guess, on the interstate.
But maybe not everywhere. Is that what I'm hearing from you both, perhaps?
And maybe not for everybody. It may be possible to dampen some of the most excessive speeding. There's a great example that's near where I live of a technique that was applied to a road that's two lanes in each direction. It had no shoulder. It was called Lawyer's Road, and it was road dieted. It did not actually need both lanes.
Excuse me, I think you said road dieted.
Yes.
I can't imagine what that is. Could you help me understand that?
Well, a road diet is where you reassign the pavement lines. Typically, it's where you look at a four-lane road, two lanes in each direction, and you look at whether you could operate it as one lane in each direction, a center left turn lane, and some, you know, extra pavement at the side that can be repurposed perhaps to bike lanes.
So that street got excessively fat. Uh-huh. And you're tightening the belt a little
bit. That's an interesting image. Fionnuala, you grew up in Ireland, and I'd like to know if that experience, growing up in a very different place, has informed your work as a planner in Northern Virginia, has given you perhaps a perspective that might be different than the typical perspective we see in Northern Virginia. Mm-hmm. Could you comment on that?
I do come out of a different world. Like, I stepped from one world into another, and it was a different transportation world that I stepped into. I didn't realize that's what I was doing at the time, but it was also a completely different transportation history, and people were making different choices in different situations. So my background was much more inclined towards, you know, walking, bicycling, using the bus, etc. Gas was very expensive, so...
I hope we can hear more about that right after our break. We're back, Fionnuala Quinn, right before our break, you were telling us about growing up in Ireland and how that gave you a different perspective than the typical one we would expect in Northern Virginia from planners and from ordinary citizens. And I wonder if you could tell us some more about that.
Yes. So as well as our transportation being different, the land use patterns were very different, which, of course, I didn't really understand when I came here. I moved to the Northern Virginia suburbs without any real understanding of how they were laid out. And our land use is very directly connected to how we move around, our transportation. So I suddenly found myself where we were only a mile from the school, but my children couldn't walk there because of the way the streets and the land is laid out. So this sort of thing was very noticeable to me and was certainly not sort of my background, where there was nobody to drive me anywhere, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I would be expected to get myself around.
So even children get around independently in Ireland, is that true?
Yes. And to this day in the cities, you know, they're very used to public buses, et cetera. Very much so. They're very transportation independent, I would call it.
Would you like to see more transportation independence among children in Virginia?
Well, yes. I don't really think 14-year-olds need to be driven everywhere. And right now, the way we have laid our suburbs out, they actually frequently don't have any other choice. They can't drive, and they're actually not able to get places because they can't cross the arterials, et cetera, even though that place is not very far away.
Well, I'd like to hear some more from both of you about how a community could be designed in such a way that children, 14-year-olds at least, could get to the school or the library or the store or wherever they want to go without being chauffeured by a parent.
It's the kind of thing, I think, that does not have to be master planned by a faraway genius and you have to start from scratch. Now, I grew up in the Virginia suburbs of Washington, D.C., and in the certain area that I was, it wasn't a huge master planned community where someone said, we want walking and biking for people of all ages and physical abilities. But it just so happened that this part of Fairfax County was very much like that. So I had that ultimate freedom of being able to ride my bike all sorts of places. So, and it didn't matter that I was tall, my sister was short, she could keep up with me. We could ride just about wherever. So riding to the pool was not a big deal. That was just something we did. Little Caesars used to have their big boxes of pizza. We could ride a mile to the grocery store and pick up pizza, hang soda on the handlebars, and ride home with that sort of thing.
But I think that might be an unusual experience already because, as Fionnuala said, we are driving our 14-year-olds to practically every destination they want to reach. And I wonder what it takes to make that sort of city or suburb or town possible.
Well, I've actually seen some great examples of what it takes. And I saw one in my own county in the last couple of years where there were several neighborhoods backing up to each other, but no internal connection in the block. And our county installed a small fiberglass bridge, about 100,000, across a stream and connected up trails in between cul-de-sacs internally within the neighborhood. Right away, the middle schoolers all realized they could get to their middle school by bike much more quickly than taking the school bus that went all the way around into all the neighborhoods picking the kids up. And they had a huge boom in kids biking to that school because of this little internal connection that got added.
So by internal connection, you mean a dedicated path just for the kids on their bikes and on foot to use? Is that right?
This was a community facility. This was a trail in the woods, and just this little connection was added. The kids, nobody had been thinking about the kids at the time. This happened spontaneously after the bridge got installed.
So the kids themselves made this happen once they saw that there was a way to do it.
Absolutely.
And what else can we do to encourage children to and teenagers to get where they want to go without being chauffeured? Is there something else we can do as well?
I think some of it, when we're looking at the streets, whether it's inside the neighborhood or it's the streets on the edges of neighborhoods, you have to stop and think, who belongs in these streets? Are we intentionally discriminating against kids? Are we trying to keep them off the streets and off? Are we saying we're not going to build any sidewalks because we don't want people walking? Well, we know human nature. If a person needs to walk or they choose to walk, they're going to walk. So are you going to accommodate them or not? So now when we go back as a public works department or a state department of transportation and you start looking at your street and you use terms like we're going to improve the corridor out front of your home or we're going to improve your neighborhood streets, who are you improving it for? Are you improving for more trips in the car, forcing your parents to drive you all over the places? Or are you improving it for kids during the day or even after dinner when their parents are home to be able to move around?
Andy Baino, you're reminding me that you've challenged some of your colleagues to question the conventional wisdom in your field. I wonder if you could give us another example of that kind of questioning. So, Andy, I was asking you about how you've challenged some of the conventional wisdom in urban planning. Could you say some more about that?
So, yeah, one of my pet peeves that I would jump on would be design speed. And that's just simply when engineers are asked to design a street or redesign a street that's already existing, they come up with a certain speed. So that might be, they say, well, 45 miles an hour is what we're going to post the speed limit as. And then they design that to accommodate vehicles to drive usually 50 or 55 miles per hour. So there are a few things that are wrong with that as far as a human being is concerned. Most often that number, that speed is just arbitrary. It's just, well, we're going to do 45 miles an hour because we've always done 45 miles per hour, or at least for the last 50 or 60 years we have. And then you run into this other problem of safety where if you're a person walking and you're hit by a car that's driving 40 miles per hour, you're almost guaranteed death. If you're walking and you're hit by a car that's only going 20 miles an hour, you're almost guaranteed life. So we hear this term about livability and being a great community. Livability is a term that describes a great place. I would say for livable transportation, I describe those big, fast neighborhood streets as the opposite of livable. It's killable. It's dangerous by design, we say in our profession.
I can see why that might be provocative among some of your planning colleagues. Fionnuala Quinn, you've taken a special interest in women's perspectives in urban design. I'd like to know if you could tell us some more about that.
I really have taken an interest from the engineering side. You know, given my background as an engineer, I've always been conscious of the, you know, much lower representation of women in the field. I have to say, my daughter, when she was six, she said to me, she said, "Mom, can a boy be an engineer?" And that's because I have lots of lady friends, obviously, who are engineers. But, you know, I had to explain to her there's really only 10% of the profession is female. We're graduating about 20% right now nationally. So we definitely, you know, when we're designing, which is about every aspect of our life, really need, you know, full representation within that, the design profession. Because when you're designing, you're thinking about how do people live, et cetera, et cetera. So I've actually had a number of involvements, including I have a program I run in a school for fifth and sixth grade girls to encourage them to consider engineering, and we have a lot of fun with that.
So that tells us something about how we could have more women in the profession of planning. Mm-hmm. I wonder about the people that planners serve, the citizens, the residents, the people going to work, the people mm-hmm. at home, the people in the neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. Do women not the expert planners, but the citizens, do they have particular needs or perspectives that you have seen and perhaps are more alert to as mm-hmm, a planner?
Mm-hmm. Well, I've actually tried to tackle the other side also, which is community members engaging in the design conversation. Because again, I think everybody needs to think about, is this the world we live in? We want to live in? How would I like it to be? And generally, if you go to a public meeting about transportation or if you go in front of a state transportation board, you'll find there's very few women's voices speaking up. So I've tried to assist with that aspect of women's engagement, first pointing out the lack and also starting to create some programs. And I've actually had some hands-on programs where, you know, we have models of design and talk about all the different aspects of design, why we do things, to try and encourage and give people the language that they need to go in and say things about, you know, how they want their streets. It's intimidating to speak out on these topics.
Well, messages are we missing when we intimidate a citizen out of commenting, perhaps a woman citizen out of commenting at a forum about a planning proposal or a planning need? What messages or needs are we not hearing about?
Just the very everyday needs of using the streets. You know, how we cross at intersections. How do we get across to the children's school? You know, all the aspects of everyday travel through the landscape, how we want our children to be able to move around. These are not, I must stress, just women's concerns. You know, we need representation speaking up on these issues. It's really, there is a lack out there on the topic.
I'd like to know about how you talk to local residents, how you advise them, perhaps without coming off as people who know what's best for everybody else. Do you have ways of finding out what local residents want in their communities and how to serve them? Or do you find you actually do have all the right answers and you want to just set people straight on what they really need?
So this might shock you, Peter, but I have a short answer to this. I think what I try to do is to tell inspiring and sometimes provocative stories, real stories. Sometimes that's a story about a place that exists today, or it's about when I grew up, riding the bike with my sister to get pizza in a movie. A good idea does not require force. It doesn't require the heavy hand of a huge government. So this isn't about big spending versus low spending. It's just about good ideas. And if you can share good ideas and get people excited about it, and they can see that idea applied in their community, a lot can be done.
But you can't just hand people a 50-page report and say, get inspired. So what do you do instead?
You got to be able to tell stories. You have to be able to look around you, take a step back, getting away from that kind of engineering. If you're a civil engineer, that engineering worldview that you were trained in, or if you're a planner, that kind of planning policy worldview, and just think every day, what do my 8 and 10 year olds see when they walk to the edge of the street? What does the 14-year-old see when they're riding their bike through a street?
I've spoken to you, Fionnuala Quinn, about some of the techniques you have as well. I think one includes physical models that people can manipulate. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes. I have developed a kit where we could turn the whole office table into a street, and we can have cars and all the lane markings and all the devices on the street. And we can move them around and talk about why we would do that and why it would be safer, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I've realized that even when we stand up and explain these things very rationally, that different people hear a different way. There's a lot of emotional aspects to what we're talking about. This is people's community and neighborhood. So we have to take all different approaches and, you know, try to meet people in their language and in different ways. And I have to say, another great thing is to, you know, in order to reach people, is to go out to them, to set up, if you need public input, go to the farmers market, go to events in the community. It's very hard for people to come out at night, et cetera, to give input into these sort of things. And the other exciting thing is we have all these new tools now through social media, et cetera, that allow people to give input, you know, from home or on their phone, et cetera, that may be more fun sometimes. So we're reaching different people.
I'm imagining that we have a listener out there who would like to have a bike path, one of the internal connections that you mentioned before, perhaps some other design feature in their community that they don't have now, and they'd like to have it. And I'd like to know, what's your advice for such a listener? How can they help make such a thing happen?
The first is probably speak up. I mean, what we find a lot of times is after sharing an idea, you hear, well, that sounds great. I sure would love that, but it'll never happen. or you don't understand my town, you don't know my city, they'll never go for that. So it takes a little bit of courage for somebody to say, I'm not an expert, but here's what I would like to see. That's what I encourage people to do. Don't try to be an expert. Embrace the fact that you aren't an expert, but you live there, and say, hey, local council person, you know what? I have to get on the bus, or my kids have to get on the bus and drive miles to get to the school, like Fionnuala was talking about. But if you just had this tiny little connection, we could all walk and bike around here, and it would imagine all the time savings for these kids.
Yes, I've seen lots of great people start these initiatives and do unbelievable things. It does typically take somebody, a champion, who sees something in the community, and they come out and they express their idea. And sometimes it may take, expressing it, bring people on a walk through the area to show the possibilities, create some nice drawings, find your friends, create all sorts of coalitions and connections, particularly with the people who have authority over such matters, show why this thing is great, what all the benefits would be, et cetera, et cetera. There's often money out there to help you with these sort of projects. And I have to say, there's a great example near me again of a mom in the community. She moved to a new house. She wanted to be able to walk to the park with her young child. It was very close to her house. Then couldn't believe that she couldn't do it. The end result is she has turned into this incredible advocate for all sorts of improvements. But there is a pedestrian bridge across a highway near us that when we drive under, we always go, there's Jennifer's bridge.
So she,
which
made
is
it
the
happen.
End result of her work, trying to get her small child to the park. So, yeah, people, the regular community can make these things happen and are the only ones who really can make these happen.
But in an era of tight budgets, local, state, and federal, how can we talk about expensive new infrastructure for pedestrians and bicyclists? Surely that's far-fetched or implausible.
So there's some jargon that's easy to find if you just search online or search Twitter, tactical urbanism or incremental design, incremental urbanism, things like that. What it means is short term, sometimes low cost fixes to make a little place a little bit better. So, for example, you might have an intersection where two busy streets meet, and busy in terms of all throughout the day, there's some activity happening. Well, if you go out there with some duct tape, they say duct tape fixes everything, and just put duct tape in where you think a curb might be better, and then you see, oh, wait a second, we didn't need 14-foot wide travel lanes for vehicles. We can get away with 10-foot lanes, and now we have extra space to do this on the side, and now we have extra space for landscaping. So there's all kinds of opportunities with low cost, assuming you can afford some duct tape.
Sounds like you're doing this kind of stuff on your own then. We'll talk more about this after our break. We're back on Virginia Insight. We're talking with community designers Fionnuala Quinn and Andy Baino. They have lots of ideas about community design and lots of experience as professionals in the field. So Andy and Fionnuala, we've been talking a lot about accommodating pedestrians and bicyclists, but let's face it, Americans prefer to drive. They like to be able to drive where they want to drive. And as planners, really, isn't it your job to make sure that they can?
So a couple things. You often hear the phrase war on cars. If there is some kind of war out there, I would say it's a war on dangerous design. It's a war on dangerous design in the sense that we're trying to make places better for people, safer for people, regardless of the vehicle that they're in. So who knows what vehicles are going to look like 20 years from now? Whatever we're traveling in, we want to be able to be safe in it. If we're in the United States, if we're seeing anywhere from 25 to 40,000 people, depending on which years you're looking at, die on highways every year, that sounds like a crazy high number. Like, how can we say that our streets are so great when thousands and thousands of people die on our streets all the time? And those are car crashes. That's not thousands of pedestrians, tens of thousands of pedestrians that are being killed. The other thing is, when you're in a vehicle, you at some point presumably are going to become a pedestrian. You're going to have to get out of that car unless you live in a place where you can drive through everything. But most of us, at the beginning of our trip and at the end of our trip, if that's a car trip, we still become a pedestrian. So there are a couple of kind of underlying philosophies that you have to remember. We are designing for people at the end of the day.
And I would take on, we first have to consider there are actually a lot of people who can't drive or who don't drive. There's about 30% of the population who's not driving. So we have a significant group, and there are different ages, different abilities. We're also thinking about ourselves at all life stages. We may be driving now, but will we always be able to? Would we like to be able to have another option, not feel pressured when we're in our late 80s to still drive because we have other options in the community? Maybe I would actually challenge whether everyone does like to drive. I live in an area where I think there are a lot of people who might say otherwise. I have to say bicyclists are the only people who extend their commutes around me where I live. And really what we're doing is when we facilitate choice in terms of moving through the built world, we're actually helping it for the drivers. We're removing people off the streets who may be out there clogging the arterials, doing 1 mile trips because they have no choice. We're trying to get those short trips out of the mix to facilitate the trips that really need to be, you know, in the cars, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, nobody's removing choice. We always have the driving, you know, we have all that infrastructure built. We're now trying to add the other bits so we can allow the other uses also.
So when I read in the news that something like 98% of Americans who commute to work do so by driving alone, maybe that's not just a vote for that mode of travel. Maybe that's the sign that there aren't good alternatives. Does that sound right?
There are a lot of people that are trapped in those situations. I mean, there are a lot of people that we see after the housing bubble popped where they're stuck in isolation and forced to drive. So yeah, there are a lot of people that are trapped. And then also, like Fanula said, she made me think of, you know, the age issue. If you hear somebody promoting that we have to only design streets for a small bracket of, say, 20-somethings through 50-somethings, I would say to that person, well, why do you hate kids? Why do you hate the elderly? I mean, people aren't thinking about the ramifications of their design choices if they're only thinking about designing for a small percentage of the population. And then again, about the short trips, there's so many trips during the day that we take. I'm sure all of us, if we're in an area or visiting an area where the streets are designed for automobiles, you don't have a choice but to drive 1 mile away to the grocery store.
I'd like to change the conversation and ask about the future. If we grow as we've grown in the past, following the status quo, what kind of future do you see for Virginia communities in 20 or 30 years?
Well, we're in a time of great change in general, and that's actually exciting for transportation. There's dramatic changes in the transportation conversation because of the availability of information, and that's going to allow us to be a lot smarter in looking to how we operate our roads. And how we move people around. You know, right now we spend a lot of time sitting at traffic lights where nothing is happening, et cetera, et cetera. We're going to get smart about a lot of that stuff. So I see all that coming into play. We're also going to be able to look at our choices. And you can already do this where you can flip up apps on your phone and say, I want to get from A to B. What are all my choices? And it'll give you the time, distance, money, et cetera, et cetera. And we're going to see a much better version of that. And I'd also like to see, we already understand a lot of ways where we can make the roads we have operate better and more safely. And I'd like to see a lot more of that applied in a way that makes our roads, you know, more friendly and more comfortable for all of us. Like if I look 30 years into the future, I want to be able to, in my 80s, still get around on my bike to the local store, et cetera, et cetera. And that's really very feasible in a comfortable environment.
Yeah, if we just follow status quo, Peter, it's just at some point it's an asphalt wasteland. And your perspective on street design does not have to be a save the earth mentality. You might hate baby seals. It doesn't matter. At some point, it's not practical to just add add lanes for all the cars that your model swears are going to appear. At some point, you can't physically pave everything.
Well, then let me try this question in a different way, which is, let's say we look at options we haven't looked at before. We pick items on the menu of choices that we haven't chosen before. What kinds of futures can we expect or hope for or strive for in our small communities, cities, suburbs, and large cities?
I think a lot of it, I mean, if you think back, the term suburbs gets a has a bad reputation a lot in the planning world. But if you think back to what was initially attractive about the suburbs, it's that they were so family friendly. The suburbs were not designed to be an isolationist kind of community where you just go and disappear from the rest of mankind. The idea was you had this comfortable place with schools and places to shop and all this kind of thing in this community, and maybe you would travel to a workplace at some point, but it was family friendly. So I think looking to the future, if you think, what are ways that we can keep designing communities or redesign our existing communities in a way that, whether it's single people, it's young people, it's older people, whatever stage of life they are, that it's comfortable and inviting for them. And so much of that has to do with street design.
This is Virginia Insight. I'm Peter Norton, sitting in for Tom Graham. We have phone lines open at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. Fionnuala Quinn, we've just heard from Andy Baino about what the future could be, good or bad. And I'd like to know if you agree with Andy. Do you see a future in which we end up having to pave half the state to make room for automobiles? Do you see other alternatives ahead of us?
Yeah, I don't see that need at all, because I see lots and lots of opportunity in what we already have right now. And a lot of what we have, the way we're using it for some people is for very long trips. So we may see some changes in where people choose to locate. And we're already seeing that trending in the young people who are saying, I don't want to drive long ways. I want to, you know, sit on the train and play whatever, Angry Birds. They want to do other things with their time. They can catch up with their emails, etc. So we're looking at people changing how they travel, and you want to be able to get there safely, and that's an aspect of it too. So in the future, I would like to see us applying what we understand about safety in the design of how we do all this.
Now, we've been talking a lot about how people get to work or get from place to place, walking, by bicycle, by car, perhaps by bus as well. I'd like to know if you can tell us a little bit about what our choices might be for what we find once we get to where we're going. We have a pretty good idea of what we find right now. I wonder if you could contrast some alternatives for us, perhaps ones that are being tried in other countries or other towns, about what might be different about the places we arrive at once we've traveled already.
Well, in terms of where you're arriving, I think that what that makes me think of is town centers and city centers. One, cities and towns are destinations. And something that often gets lost in the engineering and the planning world is when you start looking at a very specific corridor, a street from point A to point B, you think of it as this funnel where it might be cars, it might be water, whatever. You're thinking of a street as just a linear funnel to get things out from one side to the other. But a city or a town, it could be a very small town. It could be a town. It could just be the intersection of two highways in a rural place where there's a little market on one side and a couple of farmhouses on another. But that is your destination. That is your place. So once you're inside of that small town or village or even a big city, you're there. You don't need to be speeding through from one point to another. So there are going to be a lot of destinations within that city or that town. But it, we have to separate, I think, those destinations from how fast do you really need to get there. I mean, Fanula made a point. I don't know if you heard her mention this, but bicyclists are extending their commutes. I mean, who says, I don't mind if I have a 30-minute commute or 25-minute commute instead of a 10- or 15-minute commute? I mean, there's something very interesting, I think, about that.
Wait, are you suggesting it's possible that people might enjoy their commutes?
Right. It's amazing, isn't it? And that's even oftentimes without earbuds in.
Well, let's talk some more about what you find once you get to the urban center, as you mentioned, Andy. So an example that comes to my mind is that in New York City recently, the city experimented with closing Times Square to traffic and putting lawn furniture in. And my understanding, just based on reading the news, is that was a controversial idea. But once it was tried, people pretty much liked it. Does that suggest to us that we may have lots of other alternatives that we can try, even in places like Harrisonburg, let alone New York City?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, New York has been taking the lead on this for the last decade in terms of really, they're very constrained in terms of their streets. They really have to look closely how they move people around. And they have a lot of visitors and a lot of people who live their lives out in the street. So they looked closely at their streets, created all these public spaces, by closing off areas, and they turned out to be unbelievable successes. They were measuring everything that they were doing. They were not doing this without looking at the impacts. And one of the end results is they've shown they've saved almost 1,000 lives on the streets of Manhattan in the last 10 years. And they've put out some great documents. There's one called Measuring the Streets that shows all the benefits for all the different users. Because you have to think about, you know, the trucks, how are we going to make deliveries, et cetera, et cetera. So they've been measuring how it impacts everybody and the economic benefit. Well, all of what they've done has actually been really by just looking closely at what you've got, seeing what makes sense, using paint, using new curbs, using little bits of concrete, et cetera, et cetera. And that really applies everywhere. And certainly Harrisonburg is a great place. And I know there have been people already looking at opportunities in Harrisonburg, because I know there's a great rail trail opportunity here that people are out looking to see what you can add to the city. And these, over and over, when these projects go in, people vote with their feet. People love having somewhere to go, somewhere friendly to participate in their community. People love their communities.
Andy Baino, I think I recall that you've been personally involved in projects in Richmond that invite people to enjoy the city in new ways without necessarily just viewing the city as a place to get from point A to point B, but as a place to enjoy. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, and I'm definitely not alone, but there have been a growing number of people participating in Parking Days, one event that turned into a couple of other people designing parklets that they presented to the city and said, hey, we'd like to do this permanently. And what a parklet is taking an on-street parking space, which is usually about 8 feet wide by 20 feet long, and just making it, often temporary, a piece of the public space. So that might be a chair and a table. It might be some sod. It might, who knows? But Parking Day is an event once a year that says, what could we do in this on-street parking space that many times, in Richmond as an example, isn't used for vehicle parking? So
let me see if I understand this. You take a curbside parking spot and you turn it into a parklet. What does that look like?
It could look like just about anything. It depends how big is your imagination. that's what your parklet could look like. Architects go crazy because they like to build stuff. Landscape architects like to have greenery and flowers. So it all depends what you want to see. So to your question about people enjoying their city, it's things like that get people thinking, I really do like the place that I live outside of looking at, you know, I like it better outside on my 2 feet or sitting in a chair rather than just looking out the windshield of my vehicle.
Could I get you each to just say what your message is for Virginians about what they can make their communities?
We've got all sorts of wonderful cities in Virginia, and we have a lot of historic cities that have great networks. It would be wonderful to restore community life to the public streets.
I'd like to see Virginians go back to their old roots of being nonconformists. That's what it takes to get a beautiful, safe, inviting community.
Thank you for being with us today on Virginia Insight, Fionnuala Quinn and Andy Baino. Virginia Insight's executive producer is Matt Bingay. Our associate producers, Bob Levicky, Terry Ward, and Dan Easley. Some of our break music is supplied by Robert Jospe and Inner Rhythm. Thanks to you, the listeners, for tuning in to this edition. I'm Peter Norton, guest hosting today for Tom Graham. It's been a pleasure being with you. Join us again for more insights.